Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn. Standing on an open-air stage in France during the European summer is a group of young men dressed in the traditional robes of the Tuareg from the Sahel in West Africa. The group is from Niger and they're called Desert Rebel. Known as the Rockers of the Desert, they're emerging stars on the world music scene.
Nous les dédions le concert au retour de la paix. Au retour de la paix au Niger. Pour que cesse les calvaires que vivent toutes les populations du Niger, de toutes les ethnies du Niger, que ça soit.
The group asks the crowd for 1 minute silence to remember the dead, people killed in the current war in Niger. They say all the suffering must end, but the reality is it's likely to get worse. Niger has one of the largest uranium deposits in the world, and everyone wants a slice of their yellow cake. It's been called the radioactive rebellion. The Tuareg say they will not be robbed of what is theirs.
Unhappy Tuaregs, wake up from your sleep. Free yourselves from the grip of time. The Renaissance is calling you. Tuaregs, don't sleep anymore. Free yourselves from the grip of time.
You're with ABC Radio National, and this is Background Briefing. I'm Stan Correy. The group is called Desert Rebel, and one of its founders is French filmmaker François Bergeron. He's been in prison in Niger, accused of helping the Nigerian Tuareg rebel group, the MNJ.
Y a pas eu vraiment de développement de la région du Nord.
Last week, he was deported to France and gave a press conference in Paris. François Bergeron told journalists that the Tuaregs simply want a better deal for their people. They say their uranium-rich land is being parceled up and sold off to the rest of the world, while their people need schools and hospitals and to protect the environment of the land of the Tuaregs. The price of uranium has skyrocketed in the past few years, and Niger is the third largest producer of it in the world. The Chinese want it, so does India. America is already there, but not only for the uranium. Niger is an Islamic country, and America has started to take an interest because it fears the Islamic extremists could get a toehold in the whole region. So, just a few weeks ago, on Pentagon TV, with great fanfare, there was the official launch of AFRICOM, Africa Command.
Working with our teammates and partners, we will focus on helping Africans build strong security structures that work for Africans.
The development of security and safety in Africa has long been a priority within the Defense Department.
The creation of AFRICOM provides opportunities to the Department of Defense to harmonize efforts on the continent from across our government.
General Ward says the time is right to have this new command.
I think the economic, the security, political, and social importance of the African continent in global affairs continues to grow. And history, culture, economics, and geostrategic significance link the African continent to the United States.
Up until recently, the French had this part of Africa all to itself. The giant uranium miner Areva has been mining there for decades. It's owned by the French government. Two-thirds of Niger's uranium is sent to the nuclear power plants that supply most of the energy for France, and also its nuclear arsenal. But Areva has competitors now. That's because in recent years there's been a constant increase in anti-French feeling in Niger. Bad labour practices and pollution problems at the two uranium mines and an unequal sharing of the revenue from uranium sales are the main factors for the animosity. The government recently expelled the French head of Areva in the country. he was accused of paying off the rebels to stop them attacking the mines. In France, President Nicolas Sarkozy took the increasing instability very seriously.
Pour essayer de renouer les fils du dialogue. Et je ne voudrais rien dire qui complique une situation qui l'est déjà suffisamment.
It is possible that in the coming days we may take some initiative to try to renew the dialogue. I don't want to say anything that might complicate a situation that is already complicated enough. Niger is an important country for us, since it's the main producer of military uranium, which explains the presence of Areva there.
Analysts are saying that Niger has become, quote, a threat to international security. Many people don't even know where Niger is. This is British anthropologist Jeremy Keenan.
Without being rude about poor old Niger, it's one of those countries in the world, a bit like Chad and Mali, because it's right in the middle of Africa in the north. It's landlocked. It's easiest to pick out. Its neighbour to the north is Algeria, the south, Nigeria. So it's kind of stuck in between Algeria to the north, Nigeria to the south. The southern part of the country is savanna and scrub. It moves into what we call Sahel, the local word for the shore of the Sahara. So we talk about the Sahel belt or Sahelian belt, which moves northwards into desert. And the uranium is right up in the north, really in the Sahara. The two mines at the moment are right next to a town called Arlit, A-R-L-I-T. And that is a real mining town. It just grew up around the mines, literally, which were, metaphorically speaking, kind of in the middle of nowhere. So the mines are right up in the north of Niger. You're about 150 miles from the Algerian border. The town of Arlit, very isolated, right in the middle of nowhere. But that nowhere is a very important place ecologically because it's part of a region called Tamesna.
This region, the Tamesna, is called the Camel's Restaurant by the Tuareg tribes because it's where the camels are sent to be fattened up to breed and give birth.
Tamesna is a vast area, probably 200, 300, 400 miles north-south, same east-west, of, I think you could say, unique pasture in the Sahara. Its uniqueness is rather strange qualities to do with the hydrology, the salinization of water deposits, wind systems and what have you. But you get within Tamesna a unique type of pasture, which historically has been used by many, many nomads, predominantly Tuareg, but other ones as well, from other countries or different regions for grazing. So Tamesna as a region, it almost has a sacred quality to it in terms of this long, more than a tradition of providing particular grazing for many, many peoples, not just the local people. So a very, very important region ecologically. And that is something that few people understand apart from locals. It's obviously quite complex.
There's been minimal coverage of the conflict in Niger in the English-speaking media. But that's not the case on French television. This is from a report broadcast in July with long shots of the Sahara and maps showing the rich deposits of gold, oil and uranium in Niger. The reporter talks about the romantic past with the Tuaregs, the lords of the desert, and there's the customary shot of Tuaregs riding their camels. But there's little romance in the current conflict. Bombings, landmines used by both sides, arrests of local journalists covering the conflict, and almost 100 soldiers killed. And in the past 2 weeks, allegations have surfaced of civilian massacres by the Niger army. The French media report also zeroes in on the real grievances of the Niger government and the Tuareg rebels. The French, the report states, are doing very well out of selling Niger's uranium on the global market. But little revenue flows back to the central government or to the Tuaregs from the sale of the yellow cake. That's the yellow powder or uranium concentrate that comes from processing uranium ore.
Le Français Areva, par exemple, exploite à bon prix l'uranium nigérien. Il paye la concession au gouvernement de Niamey.
This desert war is not your typical anti-uranium story. The rebels aren't necessarily against mining. They want a bigger share of the cake, and they don't want the mines to pollute their grazing land and water holes. So the world still lines up to mine Niger's uranium, including Australian companies. One firm that follows the global uranium market is Resource Capital Research, based in Sydney. John Wilson.
Probably over 650 explorers now who claim to have at least one project related to uranium in their portfolio. And of that 650-odd, there's probably close to 300 listed in Australia. And in terms of the number of those that are in Africa, I don't have the exact figure, but there's probably around 20 or so. There's certainly, 10 or 12 that have quite high-profile projects in Africa, from Namibia, Malawi, Zambia, South Africa, and then up into Nigeria. Even in the Congo, there are companies looking for uranium.
Some of those investors and miners are from China, and that adds another whole dimension.
China's directly going into Africa, investing directly in projects and in companies. I think that just increases the competitive forces on the ground in Africa for the juniors there who are competing to pick up exploration ground. And it's also potentially of increased interest to Western governments who see increased Chinese interest in Africa. But certainly the Chinese are moving into Africa, as are the Indians. Both countries have hosted delegations of businessmen and African politicians. They're both funding many programs in Africa.
These desert rebellions against international miners and the romance of the many different tribal groups have just come out in a new children's adventure thriller published in London. It's called The Yellow Cake Conspiracy, and the author Stephen Davies has it all there for the teenage market. There are tribal attacks on uranium mines, conflicts between the central government and the Tuareg tribes. There's French military involvement, and rumours of Islamic extremists stealing uranium. The story revolves around the friendship of two young boys, Haroun, a Fulani, and Barema, a Tuareg. A French uranium mine manager is murdered. Haroun is asked to spy by the French Secret Service. Barema and Haroun are being bussed back to their village when suddenly they stop because there's been an accident with a truck.
"What is it?" said Barema, squashed behind Haroun. "What are they looking at?" The bus driver opened his door and got out. Haroun clambered over the driver's seat and stepped down onto the road behind him. The truck had been thoroughly shot up, and there was a man slumped over the steering wheel. Haroun was still wearing his helmet lamp. He flicked it on and peered in through the window of the car. Claude Girard was dead. Haroun stepped away from the car, and the angry police officer bustled him back onto the bus. It was unbelievable. Girard had been murdered. Barema was still on the bus, with his nose pressed up against the window. He turned to Haroun and scowled. "Don't say it," he muttered. "You don't know who did this, so don't say it." "It looks like the work of your people," said Haroun. "You know nothing," Barema shouted. "I've seen your own cousins, Haroun, threatening each other with machetes over a girl. So don't stand there and tell me that Tuaregs are the only race of people under heaven with violence in their hearts." "I did not say that," said Haroun, "but it wouldn't be the first time that Tuareg rebels have killed Uranico workers, would it?"
The book's author, Stephen Davies, works for a charity, and he's spent quite a bit of time in Niger.
It's a bit like the Wild West, actually. It's a very barren part of the country. Obviously, just on the edge of the Sahara Desert there, so very dry, very hot, and a wonderful mix of different people groups, including the Tuaregs, who traditionally have been of great interest to Western anthropologists. They're the blue men of the desert, so-called. They ride camels and wear turbans, and looking in from the outside, are a very romantic, nomadic people. But in that same situation, you've also got foreign mining companies trying to exploit resources, and the tensions that that creates with the local people I found very interesting.
The tensions that Stephen Davies writes about in his thriller are not only between the Tuareg tribes and the mining companies, but also between other nomadic and sedentary groups that live in the Sahel.
Nomadic populations do tend to be marginalised often. They're kind of ridiculed as well by more powerful sedentary populations that live there. And that's very much the case with the Tuareg. They feel that the north of Niger is their territory. They've grazed their cattle and camels there for centuries, if not millennia. And they feel that any raw materials which are found on the land quite rightfully belong to them. So it is a very delicate situation, and it really does highlight the need for mining companies to do their homework before exploiting in an area, and really to try and gauge the local reactions and have good relationships as well with leaders of minority populations.
Many mining companies, of course, don't do their homework and also feel it's up to the central government to keep order and make sure local minorities are looked after.
Local peoples have seen the price of uranium rocket in the last 10 years or so. It was quite low in the 80s, I think, and then there was a resurgence. So they do see enormous amounts of wealth being created around them and quite rightly want a slice of it.
But predictably, the money hasn't been flowing through, even though promises have been made since the mid-1990s.
Now the rebel leaders are claiming that simply hasn't happened in the 10 years after the conflict. They always said, we know where we buried our guns and we can quite easily unearth them when the time comes. It seems that the time has come.
The Tuaregs dug up their guns earlier this year, and the fighting was fierce in the desert, at the same time as on Wall Street, uranium hit a high of $138 a pound in June this year. 2007 has been called the Year of Uranium. In Niger, exploration permits are being handed out, and a long list of foreign companies are lining up to get a slice of the action. The Niger government is trying to dilute the power of their former colonial masters, the French. So, enter the Chinese. Reporting on all this in their web newsletter called Uranium Online are UK-based consultants Manas Associates. Take care and remember Sudan, says Managing Director Charles Gurdon.
There you had a situation where the government was really pretty poor, not as poor as the Niger government, but it was very successful in encouraging oil exploration. And then with the proceeds of oil exploration, they managed to buy a lot of arms, and therefore the whole civil war, both in southern Sudan and now in Darfur, is basically fueled by the revenues from oil. And I think other African governments have seen that if they are able to get the tax revenue and get the resources from the extractive sector, this will give them sufficient funds to be able to buy arms or whatever, and therefore this is a major issue.
And here come the Chinese.
There is now talk about the Chinese providing helicopters to the Niger government in order to fight the rebels. If this is the case, then I think that the Chinese oil companies and uranium companies will be a major target. And I think Western companies need to consider these issues when they're going into countries. It's not to say that they shouldn't go in, but they do need to be aware of the issues and the problems.
These rumours of Chinese helicopters may be just local gossip or disinformation. But the anger against the Chinese is real. A Chinese mining executive was kidnapped in July by the Movement of Niger People for Justice, or MNJ. The MNJ said the reason they kidnapped the man is that the Chinese were not employing local workers. Charles Gurdon.
The thing about China is that they don't ask difficult political questions of governments, and therefore the relationship is predominantly an economic one. The Chinese have invested very large sums in oil mining, including uranium mining, throughout Africa, and their relationship generally with the governments is very good. Having said that, there is now increasing criticism about the way in which the Chinese operate, about their employment policies, about the fact that they ride roughshod over local communities. And I think there is now a backlash. There have been reports in the past about Chinese workers being killed in Ethiopia. There's been a backlash in Zambia over mining projects there. And what has very interesting is that because the Olympic Games are coming to Beijing, the Chinese will suddenly respond to pressure. And so when the Chinese refused at first to try and put any pressure on the Sudanese government over the issue of Darfur, as soon as the word Beijing Olympics was raised and the fact that this might be called the Genocide Olympics, suddenly the Chinese became interested. Suddenly they sent a senior envoy to Sudan. And I think that it is becoming an area which the Chinese are having to look at. And they are realizing that it's impossible to simply deal with it without any consideration of the risks.
Novels and films have often been set against the skies and deserts of Africa. The desert environment has a seductive power over unwary Westerners. This certainly happens, and as well, there are very real risks, not only physical, but political. In Niger, local laws say all foreign mining companies must deal with the central government. But in reality, they also have to deal with the demands of the local communities, where they want to mine for uranium. One of those working there is a relatively new Australian mining company, Oklo Uranium. Speaking with Background Briefing, a day after he returned from Niger, Ross Brown.
I was recently sitting in the office of one of the heads of the Ministry of Mines and Energy in Niger and looked about me, and there was something like 170 applications that needed to be processed. We are lucky enough to be ahead of many of those, and our applications will come through pretty quickly.
But getting one's application through is only one step. Before that, you have to survey and peg your claim. At the uranium-rich Timbosoy Basin, the interest is so intense, companies are pegging claims without good reason.
Yes, Timbosoy Basin is the sedimentary basin in which the uranium is contained within, and it's a certain area, and there are a lot of companies pegging, and you can be trapped in pegging parts of the Timbosoy Basin for no good reason other than you have some ground in the Timbosoy Basin.
The Timbosoy Basin is in Tuareg territory and right in the middle of the current rebellion. Field trips and flying around and landing in these remote regions in order to find out where the uranium deposits are is tricky. How do these difficulties affect the business of mining? Ross Brown.
Good question. For example, we've flown a $1.3 million geophysical survey, and we're in the middle of that. Now, the community, weeks before that survey was flown, was fully informed what it involved, how long it would take, and the people involved. So we feel that that is instrumental in dispelling some of the natural, not distrust, but it's better to have your community aware of your program and be in favour of it, or at least understand it before you traipse in.
The business of mining can mean weeks, months of fieldwork, and Ross Brown says his company is very careful about how they do it. It may involve just a couple of people with specialised equipment in a landscape that is not their own and where the local people have no understanding of what is happening.
Exploration is a very invisible process, and with short periods of activity, with long periods of inactivity. You know, the community sometimes is bemused by this activity. So we think we've avoided the angst.
Ross Brown is well aware that Western mining companies carry some nasty baggage when it comes to exploitation of the natural resources of Africa.
A lot of the big companies and even some of the smaller ones have always had that approach that it's Africa, where, you know, this is a continent that we can exploit. But that's well past now. You just have to involve local communities. They need to be fully informed. The governments need to be supportive and not corrupt.
Inappropriate and unethical exploitation must now be a thing of the past. African people won't put up with it any longer.
You have to be willing to pay royalties to local governments. You have to be willing to fund local community upliftment programs. And if you don't do that, you won't get anywhere in Africa. That's the new Africa, and that's the reality.
Ross Brown, Managing Director of mining company Oklo Uranium, based in Perth, and exploring for uranium in Africa. The Desert Rebel Music Group calls for a fair deal for the Tuareg tribes of Niger.
Unhappy Tuaregs, wake up from your sleep. Free yourselves from the grip of time. The Renaissance is calling you. Tuaregs, don't sleep anymore. Free yourselves from the grip of time.
The Tuareg people call for a renaissance for their own tribes. And at the same time, there's a renaissance in the business of uranium. In the first half of 2007, the business media were abuzz with the glow of dollars to be made in the uranium trade. Here's how one US television business program covered the U-boom.
You're watching First Business Morning News. Charlie Nidas at Peak Trading Group, sticking around for something extra there at the CME for us here on firstbusinessx.com. And one place where we've seen a great deal of interest from the electricity generators is moving back into nuclear energy. Any kind of power plays that could be on our radar screen here?
You know, Tom, they need uranium for nuclear energy, and uranium stocks have been, pardon the pun, but on fire.
Yes, they have. They haven't had a good half-life. They've really been exploding.
They're still in their full life here, Tom.
Pun after pun. Camco is the big one here, CCJ. We're powering up their atomic energy with Charlie Nidas of Peak Trading Group.
What's given the uranium trade new impetus is the fact that governments are looking to nuclear power as an antidote to their problems with global warming. Within a couple of years, the nuclear option has become a possibility, and for that you need access to uranium. In recent months, there was a decline in the global price of uranium, falling from its stratospheric high of $138 a pound to the low 70s. But everyone is betting on an upturn. John Wilson from Resource Capital Research.
It's still a very positive outlook. The demand growth for nuclear reactors is very strong, particularly out of India and China, but also the US, Russia, the Ukraine. But the uranium price level itself, the spot price, is a reaction to the balance between supply and demand. So it reflects the amount of inventory available to the market. And that can move very differently to longer-term supply fundamentals. So it's come off more recently for a number of reasons, from $138 to $75 a pound. And the utilities and primary producers have covered their requirements, and that's often the position for the Northern Hemisphere summer. There's a slowdown, and those buyers are expected to come back into the market later this year. And we're beginning to see some of the indicators suggest that the uranium price will probably turn up again later this year or early next year.
There are some very interesting new players in the global uranium market, investment funds that actually hold physical assets. John Wilson.
The other factor that's new to the uranium market is the existence of uranium funds, which are publicly and privately held funds that hold physical stocks of uranium. And they hold about 20 million pounds, or they're thought to hold about 20 million pounds. And that's a significant percentage of the annual spot trade in uranium. So those funds, they're investment funds, they're a new aspect of the market, and they're in a position to, whether they're buying or selling uranium at any point in time, to have a significant impact on the spot price. And I think that there, early in the Northern Hemisphere summer, at least one of those funds was reported to be selling some of its inventory into the market.
And where are these funds located? Are they in the States or in Europe?
In North America, one of the main ones is a Canadian-listed Uranium Participation Corp. The NUFCOR has a fund in Europe, and there's a number of hedge funds in the US that are holding physical uranium.
And as with oil, those who have access to lots of uranium will have a lot of clout and power. But uranium and nuclear power bring with them an extra dimension of trouble. Big trouble. Nuclear power for military use. In Sydney, from the company called Responsible Investment Consulting, Gordon Noble.
In recent years, of course, with September 11, there's been a debate at an international level that one of the risks around uranium is the creation of a dirty bomb. So rather than an actual nuclear weapon, that terrorists might get their hands on the capability to put together a dirty bomb, which would basically distribute radioactive material. Now, what this means is that we're starting to have the debate about uranium and yellowcake in particular being part of the overall nuclear cycle. And therefore, there's been an international debate about ensuring that there's a secure and safe supply of all of the nuclear cycle. So from the mine through to the processing of the fuel rods, that whole cycle needs to be managed.
Managing the nuclear fuel cycle and deciding who has what kinds of capacity when it comes to refining nuclear power to the point where it becomes a potent weapon has had the world on edge for decades. America, France, Israel, Russia, Pakistan, India, and potentially Korea and Iran have nuclear bombs already. What if other countries get it? other countries controlled by Islamic fundamentalists. All these possibilities are looming in the future. At the Center for International Trade and Security at the University of Georgia in America, Dr. Igor Kripanov.
Let's imagine that science and technology are rapidly marching ahead, and, you know, there will be a breakthrough in enrichment technologies that would make it possible for countries and terrorist groups to produce highly enriched uranium in a more clandestine, efficient, and technologically simple way. So in this particular case, illicit trafficking in yellowcake uranium ore would be a very important element in the puzzle of developing nuclear weapons.
Igor Kripanov is a former Soviet diplomat and an international authority on security and the nuclear fuel cycle. The new frontiers of uranium production are countries in Central Asia and Africa, and it's happening fast, and it's hard to keep tabs on it all. Already there's a great deal of missing nuclear material. It's called MUF, material unaccounted for. It's surprisingly easy to hive off everything in the cycle, from the raw uranium to the more refined material.
For example, the material unaccounted for ratio is from 2 to 4% in uranium mines. It's MUF. It means that, you know, if you divert 4% of the overall output, you know, nobody would pay any attention, even legally. But with tons and tons of production, 4% may grow into quite a considerable amount of uranium that can be illegally sold.
This material unaccounted for may not be an issue in uranium mines in highly regulated Australia, although it does happen. Earlier this year, the Olympic Dam copper and uranium mine in South Australia lost some containers of uranium oxide, or yellowcake. They reported it to the police. 3 kilos of the material were later discovered outside a miner's camp. When Background Briefing investigated, we were told that in fact nothing was lost at all. It had been a big mistake. It was a clerical error. Igor Kripanov believes that in less supervised mines, there's more potential for diversion. And there's the added complexity that uranium is often found with other valuable minerals.
Uranium coexists in many mines with the copper, with the platinum, and it's very hard to sort it out which amount goes for uranium and which amount goes for platinum, copper, cobalt, you know. So it's a very complicated procedure of accounting, and it requires a sense of responsibility and a security culture. I strongly believe that we need to use this concept of security culture at uranium mines now.
By security culture, Dr. Kripanov means a commitment to the idea that uranium and everything else in the nuclear cycle is very tightly controlled, wherever it is. That's not happening at the moment, and the International Atomic Energy Association doesn't have much of a chance of making sure of it in the near future. It will require enormous international cooperation and a lot of money. There's a database which has a record of global trafficking incidents since the early 1990s. It records all trafficking in everything from raw uranium ore to highly enriched uranium, ready to be used in weapons. The database shows that about 20% of all trafficking involves uranium in quite low potency, as ore, yellowcake, or only low-enriched uranium. That database is held at the University of Salzburg in Austria by Professor of Physics there, Friedrich Steinhausler. He spoke to Background Briefing from Brazil.
It is not that difficult if you think of the remoteness of many of the uranium mines, if you think of the relatively difficult metrological issue we have in measuring it. It's low activity, natural uranium. And it is technically not very difficult to blend it with other material to camouflage it or to hide it from detection.
For example, the crushed and milled ore can be mixed with sand and the load delivered as construction material. Yellow cake can be mixed with chemicals of the same colour as a disguise.
There are other ways where people have been very successful in falsifying the weight of trucks as they go into the facility and then being able to transport material out with the false gross weight of the vehicle. So it has happened, and it's not difficult to envisage how it could happen in the future unless we really review the counting and control procedures we have currently in place.
In the children's book, The Yellow Cake Conspiracy, there's a section describing a convoy of trucks loaded with yellow cake, leaving the mine in the interior of Niger. There are only two security guards. The convoy of five trucks has to travel over 1,000 miles of desert and rough terrain to the coast in the Republic of Benin. Sanger is the driver of the second of the five trucks in the convoy.
Sanger had been a driver all his working life. For the last 10 years, he'd worked for Uranico, driving yellowcake lorries from the Tinzar mine to the Benin coast. Tonight, he was driving B2, the second lorry in a convoy of five. The convoy was codenamed Yellow String, and Sanger was in charge. "Coming, Yellow Leader," a gruff voice crackled on the CV radio. "This is B1. Yellow String is secure and ready to roll." "I hear you, B1," said Sanger. "Let's go." The lead lorry moved off slowly, and Sanger followed suit. In his wing mirror, he saw the headlights of beads 3, 4 and 5. The large double gates of the mining compound were unbolted by unseen hands and drew apart with a loud creak, allowing Yellow String to drive out into the night. Sanger reached for the radio. "Shotgun 1, Shotgun 2, this is Yellow Leader." "We hear you, Yellow Leader. Keep your eyes open, both of you. I need you to be extra vigilant tonight." "Don't worry, Yellow Leader. The cake is safe with us." Cedar Sanger did not share the guard's confidence. Two shotguns were hardly a striking display of military might. "Yellow String is vulnerable to attack," thought Sanger. "Two rigs are not the only people with a taste for cake."
Eventually, a group of rebels get their stolen truck of uranium yellow cake far off into the desert, and they hide it down an abandoned mine shaft. That kind of story is familiar to Salzburg professor Friedrich Steinhausler.
The actual uranium exploration area traverses through these areas of unrest, and not only do you have the physical danger to the transport of the uranium ore, you have the physical threat to the officials who are supposed to inspecting these areas. I can recall that the supervision of these areas out of the capital is very difficult. You're talking about a 1,000-kilometer road leading through the desert, leading through these areas with political upheaval. And so government officials, of course, are exposed to an added physical security risk on their lives if they go and inspect these areas.
The security risk in the uranium-rich regions of Niger and Mali are predicted to go on for some time. Like the Kurds in the Middle East, the territory of the Tuaregs crosses over national boundaries. But the Tuareg tribes are not calling for a separate state. Here's an extract from the film documentary on the music group Desert Rebel. One of the group talks about how different Tuareg tribes have different political agendas.
"The interests of this and that group are much stronger than the reconstitution of a people who wander across the Sahara. And no one is interested in them joining together because they could have territorial or political claims, which would be a problem."
In Niger, for example, it's in the Tuareg's land that there is the uranium, which is the main source of wealth of the country. In other places, it's maybe the oil or the gas. So it's important interest groups.
A month ago, The Economist magazine called what's happening in Niger
a radioactive rebellion, a combustible mix of nomads, uranium, oil and poverty.
And it's definitely now a hot zone. US Special Forces troops are stationed in Mali. And last month, a US military plane had been shot at by Tuareg rebels there. Because these people, the people of Niger and Mali, are Muslims, the area is being called the Sahelian Front of the War on Terror. This has also been called the banana theory of terrorism. What that refers to is the shape of the line drawn from Afghanistan to countries like Niger and Mali. It's got a wide curve, like a banana. The theory is that Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan will want to infiltrate the Sahel on the edges of the Sahara in order to take control of the oil and uranium.
We're going to take a closer look at a crucial new battleground in the war on terror. You don't think of the dusty expanse of North Africa as a terrorist outpost, but it's where an Algerian called the Bin Laden of the Sahara, Amari Saifi, took 32 Europeans hostage a few years ago. U.S. officials worry the poorly policed, mostly Muslim region could become the next Afghanistan, a place where terrorists can take root. So working with nine African countries, the U.S. has launched an ambitious counterterrorism program there. In Algeria, ABC's Jonathan Carl takes a closer look at the danger in the desert.
This is an ABC America media report from about a year ago, late 2006. Since then, there have been continuing joint military exercises with African forces in the Sahara.
Throughout the Sahara Desert, America's elite special forces are at work, training alongside Algerian commandos, working with paratroopers in Niger, the poorest Muslim country in the world, and flying with the Mali army in skies not far from Timbuktu. The Pentagon plans to spend $500 million over the next 5 years dispatching special forces units throughout the Sahara, training North African armies to combat terrorists.
So far, no terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda have been found in the Sahel. But this American commander training troops in Mali thinks it's a definite possibility.
I don't think there's necessarily that there's a evident threat every day. However, the potential here is what's important.
Not a threat every day, but potentially important. The man who coined the term the banana theory of terrorism is British anthropologist Jeremy Keenan. He says this is mostly a bit of a beat-up by the local power brokers.
The local governments, particularly Niger and Mali, were using this sort of patronage from the United States, the so-called war on terror. They reckon if they could provoke the local populations into taking up arms and so on and so forth, they could then prove to the Americans, yeah, we've got a terrorist problem here, or these rebels. They never use the word rebel because that's too politically respectful. They call them drug traffickers and bandits and heaven knows what else. We can get more military assistance and more money from the American government. That is a major driving factor behind what is going on in the region. Local people throughout the area are resentful of this. To quote them, they say we're fed up with being manipulated, and they have been in many ways over the last few years, particularly in their being provoked.
This belief that fears of Al-Qaeda-influenced Islamic extremism are being whipped up in order to attract American money and to get America to help quell local rebellions is supported by French filmmaker François Bergeron. He was one of the founders of the music group Desert Rebel. The Niger government threw him out of Niger last week because of his work with the Tuareg. The government says they are only drug dealers and thugs. A few days ago, Bergeron gave a press conference in Paris. The war against terrorism issue was raised, especially how the Niger government was linking it to the Tuareg rebellion in the uranium-rich north of Niger.
On pourrait penser ça parce que
cette façon bloquée qu'a le gouvernement de cataloguer ce mouvement de terroristes, de trafiquants de drogue, de bandits armés, et de ne pas le reconnaître comme rébellion.
Bergeron responds that the central government keeps categorizing the rebels as terrorists, drug traffickers and armed bandits. They don't want to recognize them as political rebels because then they might have to negotiate with them. This approach, using the fear of Al-Qaeda, says Bergeron, enables the government to get access to very sophisticated surveillance technology.
Comment tu peux expliquer avec toute cette logistique d'écoute qu'il y a sur ce territoire qu'on n'arrête pas ces terroristes de salafistes?
Bergeron is then asked, if the technology is so sophisticated, how come they haven't arrested any Salafists, that is, Islamist radicals?
C'est très compliqué à les écouter. Comment ça se fait qu'ils n'ont pas arrêté, qu'il n'y a pas d'arrestation?
Ah ben, j'ai pas de réponse.
Bergeron replies, he doesn't know why. In this part of Africa, there's a heady, dangerous and constantly changing mix of alliances and enmities, much of it clouded in doublespeak and rumour. The radioactive rebellion is not only being fought out with Kalashnikov machine guns and landmines, but with guitars, at concerts, in chat rooms and websites in cyberspace, all promoting the cause of the Tuaregs. And their cause? Getting a fair share of the revenue from the uranium mines that are taking over what they consider their traditional land. Big wars and deep geopolitical problems inevitably follow the trail to these vital resources. It all has the potential to affect the whole world. Jeremy Keenan.
There's another factor here, and that's external forces. Who on the outside is fiddling around in this? Libya, Algeria, the Americans, other foreign companies, the Chinese, etc. These are sort of questions. France, and there's a big question mark there. There has been evidence of Algerian intervention from the Algerian secret services. Unclear as to why they want to do that, but the evidence itself is sort of a bit questionable. There's a Libyan factor, which is there's a strong sort of Libyan interest in the area, and Libya has the potential both to make the situation worse and to act as mediator and to resolve it. There's the question of whether France could be used in a sense to help resolve the situation, but France's position is very weak in the area. The Niger government wants it out, and the local people have told France that they no longer have any respect in the area because of Ariba. So France is in a weak position. The Americans are in an extremely weak position because of the whole war on terror syndrome and so forth. So you've got a situation where there is no obvious sort of strong party which could step in as a mediatory force. And that in itself is potentially quite dangerous.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Research, Anna Whitfield. Technical operator, Timothy Nicastri. The Yellow Cake Conspiracy is published by Anderson Press. Executive producer is Kirsten Garrett. I'm Stan Correy, and this is ABC Radio National. ABC Radio National podcast, ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.